May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Counsel, and thank you for that introduction.
The issues before the court are regarding the suspension or revocation of a driver's license. Mr. Carvalho contests the director's suspension of his driver's license following a trial de novo in Franklin County. There are two issues. The first has to do with whether or not the respondent must demonstrate compliance with the regulation regarding the filing of maintenance reports. And the second is whether Mr. Carvalho's right to due process of law was violated. Regarding the maintenance report issue, by statute, a report properly on file with the Director of Revenue can be submitted to prove any element at a driver's license suspension hearing, provided that all the requisite statutes and regulations are complied with. In this case, the relevant regulation is 19 CSR 25-30.031, paragraph 3. Permit me, I'll quote the thing in full because it's important. The paragraph states, a type 2 permittee shall perform maintenance checks on breath analyzers under his supervision at intervals not to exceed 35 days. The permittee shall retain the original report of the maintenance check and submit a copy of the report so that it shall be received by the department within 15 days from the date the maintenance check was performed.
Now, in this case, though, the trial court at trial de novo found that that occurred.
My understanding from the record, Your Honor, is not that the trial court found that it had been received within 15 days. What the trial court found was that what the trial court found was that pursuant to Turcotte v. Director of Revenue, it wasn't necessary to establish that the report was received within 15 days. They found that the 35-day rule was complied with, but not the second sentence about the 15-day receipt.
What is there about the trial court's ruling that suggests that's correct, that they didn't find more than that?
There was no, to my recollection, Your Honor, the judgment stated that the arguments made have long ago been dismissed. Made a cite to Turcotte, which was the case that said that the 15-day requirement is not mandatory. And there was never any specific factual finding that it was received within 15
right.
days,
yeah.
Or any argument to that effect either.
Well, right, but in accordance with 7301, why aren't all facts found in accordance with the judgment? That's where I quibble with your interpretation of how White applies in this case, because in White, the driver won below, right? And we said that the trial court was, you know, we would assume that all facts were found in accordance with the judgment. Here, the trial court found in accordance with the Director of Revenue, and so why wouldn't the presumption under White be that all facts were found in accordance with the judgment, which would include that the report was timely filed?
Well, Your Honor, and I would say that while that is a presumption that can be made, the fact that no evidence was presented of that, in fact, the argument presented at trial was that the rule doesn't apply, and that the trial court agreed that that the regulation need not be complied with, and that the trial court agreed that that case law was controlling, would rebut the presumption that the trial court in addition found that the evidence established compliance. It's kind of inconsistent to suggest that they didn't need to show compliance. I'm agreeing they didn't need to show compliance. Oh, and we can also assume that they did show compliance.
Well, that seems to be, it sounds like to me that what you're arguing there is a misapplication of law. But when I looked at your point relied on, it said respondent failed to present any evidence sufficient by a preponderance of the evidence, blah, blah, blah. Your point really doesn't suggest that the argument that you're making. I understand the argument that you're making is that the trial court misapplied the law, not that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support its judgment.
Well, the objection made was that that the respondent failed to present that evidence. The response from the respondent at trial was, we don't need to. The trial court agreed, you don't need to, and I find for the trial court, or I find
for the
respondent.
You're saying White says that the state does have the burden of presenting evidence?
I'm saying that White and the cases all that stem from that, where this court eliminated the burden-shifting regime that existed previously, means that every single regulation, the respondent has the duty to show compliance with.
Now, the state here says that they did, that the circuit court's record found that The argument that the breath test results were inadmissible was contrary to the records contained in Respondent's Exhibit A, and Exhibit A includes the maintenance report and shows a notation in the upper corner saying received by Ellen Strassing and the day after it was performed. So why wasn't that enough in the record to show that it was received within 15 days?
Again, there was no evidence about who Ellen, I think it's Strasswine, who that was.
But couldn't, it was, why wasn't that up to the trial court then? There was evidence and they could find it was adequate or not.
And my only reply to that would be that because the respondent's argument was we don't need to show compliance with the 15-day rule, we can't assume that the trial court made that determination.
Well, here's where I think that it's not an assumption. To me, it's a presumption that what's fair for the goose is fair for the gander rule, that if you win at trial, and we're looking at this, if I look at your point as a sufficiency argument, we would be sitting in the same chair as the trial judge saying, is there any evidence here from which a reasonable inference could be drawn that the foundation was laid and that the regulation was complied with? Why isn't that the, am I looking through the wrong lens?
I don't want to say that you're looking through the wrong lens, because I do agree. If it was just a sufficiency argument, then you would be seeing the exact same seats. But in terms of the presumptions, can that presumption be rebutted? Well, when the judge says you don't need to show compliance,
White clearly says the finder of fact can believe all part or none of the evidence of any party.
Absolutely.
So
if there's any, then why isn't that enough? There's no requirement. There's a talk about contesting evidence, but I'm assuming it was contested because you objected to it.
But you're saying here the trial court said the basis on which it decided, and it was that he thought there was no burden, not that he thought the burden was met.
Correct, Your Honor.
But I'm reading the judgment. It says petitioner's argument is contrary to the records contained in Respondent's Exhibit A, which doesn't it say, what isn't the trial judge saying then that, hey, I disagree with you. That file stamp is all I need.
And that is a possible interpretation of it. Again, I believe that the references to Turcotte and the references to prior law rebut that presumption, both in the argument and in the judgment.
Well,
the companion argument is, even if the court made that finding, there is no evidence to support the record.
Also true, Your Honor.
The finding.
The inference has to be that when it was received by Ellen Strassewine, that was somebody there. Again, that's a possibility, but there's no evidence. It's someone at the Department of Health. That's a possibility, but there's no evidence to that fact. It's a nullity, essentially.
So it was just random, could have been a neighbor? Can't you draw an inference that they note when it was received by someone that they were a person in authority? Also, opposing counsel says, and I'd love your response to that they can take judicial notice of this person is listed in the official manual as an employee of the department.
Well, with regards to the first part of that, your statement, Your Honor, obviously it's not a random person. But I would point out that Exhibit A had a cover sheet saying that it came from the Department of Revenue. That would suggest to me that whoever received it was a person in the Department of Revenue, not someone in the Department of Health, which is what the regulation required.
But that's just it. But the regulation requires it be filed with the Department of Health, not with the Department of Revenue, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't it be if the judge was familiar with the reg, which he obviously was because that was the argument levied to the court by your client, that he could properly infer that that's what that file stamp means.
And he may have inferred that. Again, I just have to point to his reference that they did not need to show compliance. And then to your second part about why couldn't the court take judicial notice of that fact, certainly the court could have taken judicial notice of that fact if the respondent had chosen to present it at trial. They didn't. This is why requiring compliance here, and explicitly requiring compliance, is so important, because without requiring them to comply, they won't do it. They just won't bother, and then they'll try to suggest, well, we could have done it later. It's not a hard thing for them to have demonstrated compliance. They could have just pointed that up.
Where does this compliance end? You're asserting you're trying to benefit from the 15-day filing requirement in the rule. The rule also requires the person performing the test to keep a copy, right?
Yes.
So does a respondent have to prove in every case that they kept a copy?
If there's a proper objection, then I would say yes. And I think they could do that easily just simply by having their form read a copy
and
is maintained.
How does that inform in any way the reliability of the test?
Well, Your Honor, the statutes and regulations that provide for admission here, they're not just about reliability and accuracy of the test. They're also about admissibility. They did away with the hearsay, the foundation, the scientific reliability, evidentiary objections that one could normally make. So these regulations are in lieu of those. We need all of these regulations. Someone in the Department of Health, Department of Revenue decide it's really important that we have these regulations to ensure accuracy, reliability, verifiability, and admissibility of this evidence. They're the ones who decide this is important, so they should be the ones who have to comply with it.
And what do we think the purpose is of requiring it to be on file with the Department of DHSS and a copy being kept by the person who examined it?
Not having been the person who wrote the rule, I have to speculate somewhat, but it could be that they want to make sure that these machines are being properly maintained. They want to keep track of what the statistics are with regards to breath alcohol results. It could be that they want to have these to main or essentially in lieu of chain of custody. If this were a civil case, if we didn't have 302, 312 allowing admissibility, there'd have to be, used to be a Frye hearing, now it's a Daubert hearing. And one of the issues could be, well, where are your records? Show us your records. We see a spike here. You didn't sign this off here. You didn't do it properly here. There was a problem. How did you fix that? We don't have the ability to make those objections because of 302, 312. So they should have to show compliance with all of those because those objections are no longer possible.
But to get to, for us to rule for your position, we have to overrule at least two cases and all of the progeny.
Correct. And those cases are Turcotte, Potts, and some more recent ones, I think, Roan.
Mm-hmm.
And we are asking that you overrule those. Those are cases, they're 30 years old, and I'm not saying that 30-year-old cases are
Except
always bad.
Roan was actually this
Roan
year.
Roan was recently. Mm-hmm. I agree. And but Roan was based entirely on Turcotte. Turcotte, Potts, those are 30-year-old cases, and those are before, not just White, but they're before Verdun. They're before cases where the argument was not just that the director had to make a prima facie case and then the burden shifted to the defendant. It was that if we made a prima facie case, I'm sorry, not that just they had to produce some evidence, but they had to rebut the director's presumption. Before Verdun, once the director put on evidence, you had to show that something had gone wrong, not just some sort of evidence to give the trial court reason to doubt. That was a much higher burden, and the burden was shifted. That's not the regime we have now. That's not the state of the law.
Counselor, you're over time. Save all your time for rebuttal.
Your Honor, may it please the court.
You may proceed.
I'm Michael Martinich-Sauter here today on behalf of the Director of Revenue. And I'd like to begin by addressing a few points that have come up in opposing counsel's opening argument and a few points that arose in the reply brief. The first point I'd like to make, and Judge Stith, you asked the question, what is the purpose of the DHSS filing requirement? And I apologize that I don't have the statutory citation, but I believe at least one possible answer to that question is that, as opposing counsel noted, records that are filed with DHSS have a special statutory admissibility status. You know, they're essentially automatically admitted. And so I think that a very sort of persuasive basis or purpose of that requirement is that we want those records filed with DHSS not to ensure reliability or to check up on officers, but just to ensure that there's a packet at DHSS that in every case can be admitted without any admissibility question.
And was that used here? Was there reliance placed on the fact that it was filed with DHSS to allow its admission?
It was not. It was not, Your Honor, and that's the reason that this Exhibit A packet came with a admissibility affidavit from DOR rather than DHSS.
So opposing counsel argues you have to comply with all the requirements, even if some of them seem technical and don't go to accuracy, because otherwise, basically, what's the point of having these requirements, and what's the inducement for the state to comply with them if we don't create some, say there's some consequence here? So your answer to that is?
Well, I think my answer to the why should the state comply with them argument is threefold. One answer is, the baseline answer that I'd like to just throw out there is that the state does try and comply with the law when it can. Setting that aside, a second answer is that, as I just noted, It's actually in the state's interest to file the reports with DHSS because they become easily admissible without having to go through some of the wrangling that we've had in this case. And so it's actually in the state's interest to do so. The third answer is that DHSS does have the authority to suspend an officer's license. And it's not, it's the standard is a bit higher than just a one-time failure to file a report. But for example, if an officer were serially failing to file reports or falsifying reports or something like that, the officer's license could be suspended. And so that, too, is an inducement to comply with this regulation.
Thank you.
Can we address your argument regarding the official manual? The cases that were cited in your brief, all but one deal with that you can take judicial notice of the identity of a state official. An employee is very different than a state official. And there is one case, the Missouri Coalition for the Environment versus Herman, that says it's a state commission staff, executive secretary. But all the other cases say state official, which looking in the manual, any employee could have quit or the manuals aren't current. State officials, there's a very different awareness of positions. So tell me why we should follow the Coalition for the Environment case and find that it's any state employee that you look in the official manual.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that in all of the cases, the judicial notice cases that we've cited, or I guess in none of those cases, did the court rely on a distinction between officials and employees, and in none of those cases did the court suggest that the nature of the person's duties.
Well, they all state you can take judicial notice of the identity of a state official. And the definition of official would not include an employee.
Yes, Your Honor. I would suggest that one issue is that in the state manual in particular, that is an official statement of the state of Missouri of, among other things, who works for the state of Missouri. It is a sort of item of information that is not open to reasonable dispute as to whether or not it was accurate, at least at the time of its compilation. Now, Your Honor raised the separate issue of, well, someone could have departed from employment after the compilation of that information, and was it accurate, you know, at any given time after the compilation of information? I think that would be true as to the official manual for both employees and officials. For example, the official manual could be compiled, and it could list a particular person as, you know, Attorney General.
But there are cases that don't require judicial notice of the official manual, but just permit judicial notice of a state official's identity. So you don't need to, at least under those cases, you don't need to rely on the official manual.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would say if the court were to draw the distinction between employee and official, that distinction would make the most sense where the court is taking judicial notice without reference to the official manual.
Was the trial judge asked to take judicial notice?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of.
Then is it proper for the trial court to take judicial notice if not requested to do so?
Well, Your Honor, our argument is not that the trial court should have or did, but rather, for example, as I read the Missouri Coalition for the Environment case, the appellate court took judicial notice in the first instance. It's our reading of the law that the appellate court can, in fact, take judicial notice when it's appropriate.
And you're saying it's appropriate in this case?
Well, we would suggest that the official manual is precisely the sort of source that is not subject to reasonable dispute, particularly on an issue like this.
I mean, in a divorce case, right, and there's a contested issue is what one of the parties' income is, and no one introduces any evidence of the official manual, and the judge on its own decides to, hey, well, I'll look up in the official manual and see what. Would that be proper? Would that be appropriate? And none of the parties knew about it?
I would say yes and no. I would say it could be appropriate for determining the limited question of what is that individual's salary. But it would not necessarily be appropriate to answer the full question in a divorce case, for example, because the relevant question isn't what is your salary in your your job, but it's the broader question of what is your total income, what are your total assets, and things like that. So even in that case, I'm not sure that the trial court could do what Your Honor is suggesting, because the question is not strictly what is your state salary, but it's a broader question that couldn't be answered by reference to the official manual.
Because here the relevant issue is, according to opposing counsel, is which department employed Ms. Strassen, and that the manual would tell you whether or not she was still employed or not, that she was employed by DHSS and not by revenue. Is that right?
Correct. It would answer the question of was she employed by DHSS versus Department of Revenue.
But since no one asked the trial court to take judicial notice of that, is all this simply a hypothetical discussion?
Well, I think our argument is, Your Honor, that this court can take judicial notice and it can find on appeal that it was appropriate to admit.
Is that the issue, or does it matter whether the trial court had sufficient evidence at that time? And if the trial court didn't know it had sufficient evidence, did it have sufficient evidence?
But on the latter question, I think the answer would be no. On the former question, I think the question is there any basis in the record to sustain admissibility? That would be our position, and that's the argument that we're making. But we are not making the argument that the trial court sort of, silently took judicial notice without being asked and without recording it in the judgment. And we do not make that argument. I don't think that argument would be.
And supportive. Do you think you need us to take judicial notice on appeal, or do you think there's an adequate basis on the record to find the court had substantial evidence without that?
Well, I do think that the point that because the relevant regulation requires filing this record with DHSS and not with, for example, DOR, that legal fact, coupled with the fact that there is a date stamp with an official's name that opposing counsel doesn't dispute is a stamp of a state, office, those facts taken together are certainly sufficient to give a judge a basis to find that the regulation was complied
with. Well, it's not just that. You've got a whole stack of records from revenue, only one of which has this stamp, which suggests that it's not a revenue stamp. You have two copies of this test in that stack. One has no stamp on it at all, and it comes apparently from the officer's records. And the other has the stamp, which again suggests compliance. It's a lot more than nothing for the trial judge to infer without ever diving into a state manual, hypothetically or otherwise.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to quickly touch on a few points flowing out of Mr. Carvalho's reply brief. One very brief point is that for the very first time in the reply brief, Mr. Carvalho appears to suggest that his substantive due process rights have been violated. The state would point out that Mr. Carvalho did not address substantive due process at all in his opening brief, and his point relied on number two, expressly related only to procedural due process. The state would suggest that Mr. Carvalho has waived any reliance on substantive due process, and the court should not rely on that doctrine in deciding this case. I'd also like to address the use of the term immediately in the implied consent warning at issue here. And the accuracy of the term immediately is, in many ways, a question of statutory interpretation, in the sense that it is a question of what are the legal consequences of a refusal to undergo the breath test under Section 302.574. And we would suggest, in addition to the points that we made in our brief, several additional factors strongly support the accuracy of the term immediately. Perhaps most importantly, the General Assembly has expressly required the use of the term immediately. In 577.041.2, the legislature has prescribed what an officer must tell the stopped person before administering the breath test. It is essentially the General Assembly's own summary of what it believes the legal consequences are of a refusal to undergo the test. And that provision requires that a stopped person shall be, quote, informed that his or her license shall be immediately revoked upon refusal to take the test. Now, that statutory prescription, essentially the General Assembly's own summary, is a persuasive guide to interpreting what the legal consequences are of a refusal to undergo the test under 302.574. In addition, Section 302.574.1 requires that if the driver refuses to undergo the test, the officer making the stop must, on the spot, issue a notice of revocation, must on the spot seize the driver's license and must at that time issue a temporary driving permit. And all three of those actions would be difficult to explain were it not the case that the driver's license was immediately revoked. It'd be bizarre to immediately on the spot seize the driver's license if that license remained entirely effective and the driver could continue to use it. It would also be difficult to explain the need for issuing a temporary driving permit on the spot if the driver could drive away using his or her license. Courts ordinarily interpret statutes to avoid those sorts of, you know, sort of unusual, inexplicable results, and we would ask the court to avoid interpreting 302.574 in a way that renders those actions difficult to explain. One additional point that I'd like to address briefly is that in his reply brief, Mr. Carvalho disputes that Matthews against Eldridge provides the appropriate procedural due process standard for his challenge to the implied consent warning. He suggests that the court should apply the Mullane standard to that particular challenge. And the state would make two points in response to that. First, Mr. Carvalho does not cite any case that applies Mullane to this sort of procedural due process challenge. In contrast, for example, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and United States against Harrington did apply the Matthews against Eldridge standard to a substantially similar procedural due process challenge to an implied consent warning. So we would suggest that the authority that exists on this issue supports applying the Matthews against Eldridge standard. We would also point out that Mr. Carvalho doesn't really explain how his challenge to the implied consent warning fits within the Mullane rule, which requires notice of the pendency of an action that might affect his legal rights. That doesn't really capture the sort of argument that he's making, and again, we would suggest that Mullane is not the proper standard. Unless the court has any further questions, which I'd be glad to answer, I will yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Before you get started, could you address what the proper notice is that should that you state that due process requires?
And you're speaking hypothetically, Your Honor. I assume like what I believe is a proper notice.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that proper notice would be the same sort of notice as provided by Iowa or Illinois, which is, and I'm going to paraphrase very slightly, it's you've been arrested on probable cause for driving while intoxicated. Determine the alcohol or drug content of your blood, I'm requesting a sample of your breath. Assuming this is your first driving while intoxicated arrest, if you refuse, your license will be suspended for a year. If you consent and your blood alcohol content is above the legal limit, your license will be suspended for 3 months. That statement comports entirely with the law. It is not misleading.
But is under in Iowa and Illinois, is the license suspended automatically if once the person blows over the legal limit?
I'm not certain about that, Your Honor.
Go ahead and answer his question.
I'm not certain of that, and I did want to talk about the immediately issue, an automatic issue, but Your Honor.
Why is any pre-suspension as opposed to pre-revocation notice even required by due process? Procedural due process.
Because a lawful request is a necessary requirement to getting a breath test result. That's why. They have to
for purposes of what? For purposes of the criminal law? I mean, I thought that Missouri has a statute that says that if you're operating a vehicle that you consent to a breath test. Why isn't the fact that that's out there sufficient notice to satisfy due process, given all the subsequent deprivation notice and proceedings, which you've had full benefit of?
Because the part of what makes the implied consent law lawful is that one has the opportunity to make an informed decision to comply with it or not. They're provided the opportunity to decide, okay, I'm going to agree with the implied consent and provide a sample, or I am going to withdraw my implied consent and suffer the consequences thereof. That was the Tesson decision. You have the right under due process to make that informed decision, as informed as one can be in the circumstances.
Right. And so different states in different ways try to comply with that. But why isn't just the, I mean, of course, you know, the notice on the revocation gives you a right to counsel. And you work at a law firm where you do lots of this kind of work, and you know the intricacies better than most. But do you think do citizens and lawyers, aren't they presumed to know what all these statutes say? And why do you think it's necessarily helpful that a notice that is partially correct, which includes a right to call a lawyer, is more harmful than no notice at all?
Well, you phrase it as a notice that's partially correct and includes the right to contact a lawyer. I would first argue it's not partially correct. It is actually misleading. It is inaccurate. Secondly,
You argue that as to the revocation. You don't really argue that as to the suspension.
I argue with regards to the suspension because implicitly by not mentioning it, it is inaccurate. And the example I would use is...
Well, that gets back to my point, whether you really have to give them any pre-test information at all as it relates to suspension.
And kind of linking back to any pre-test information with regards to revocation, if I offer somebody a bet, I'll flip a coin, it comes up heads, you win a dollar. Everyone is going to take that bet every single time I offer it because there's no downside. Mm-hmm. But if I offer that same bet and say, but if it comes up tails, you owe me 50 cents, mm-hmm. I've now explained the downside to you and your analysis changes. When the implied consent is given, it states, I want a sample, give it to me, or you'll lose your license.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, the necessary implication from that, in fact, Mr. Carvalho's testimony was he believed that by doing this, he would be able to drive home.
You're saying that he would think that it doesn't matter, he was driving drunk, he could keep his license if you didn't tell him that that violates the law?
He thought that he'd be able to at least have, there would not be a suspension that followed from his consent to a sample. He was convinced that if he refused to give a sample, he'd lose his mm-hmm. license. If he gave a sample, there'd be no action against him. Now, I'm sure he understood. Everyone understands that if you blow above, you're going to have a criminal charge. But that's different than this separate civil suspension that Missouri has decided to have out there and then spring on a driver after they give a sample. And finally, if I might, just with regards to the automatic issue, 302.574 Section 3 should be dispositive of this. It states the suspension does not begin revocation does not begin until the report is received by the Director of Revenue. That's in fact logical. If an officer takes your license, it doesn't magically inform the Department of Revenue that your license is suspended. They need some further notice. Now, how that interacts with the 15-day temporary permit, that's debatable, I suppose. I would suggest that the most logical explanation is that the suspension goes into effect at 15 days or upon receipt and can be backdated 15 days, but
you keep mixing up suspension and revocation in your argument.
That
you're confusing the rest of the folks out here who don't know what you're talking about.
I apologize, you're right. The revocation begins under 302.574 upon receipt of the report or 15 days, whichever comes second.
Right. Your client wasn't revoked.
He was not.
Your client was suspended. What notice did your client get regarding the suspension?
He never got accurate notice. The only thing he got was that notice of suspension.
I'm not talking about the revocation.
No.
Once he blew the breathalyzer, what notice did he get about what his proceedings what he could do to follow?
He got a form that also misinformed him about what was going to occur. The form states, you are arrested on probable cause for driving while intoxicated. Your license will be suspended. That's not the standard by which a driver's license suspension occurs.
Why isn't that where the discussion belongs, as opposed to what he was read about the refusal, which wasn't imposed?
Well, our argument was that there's never sufficient. It's that both are part of what the notice he receives. He's got the pre-test implied consent and the post-result paper notice. Neither one ever correctly informs him of what's occurring. And because of that, his due process rights were violated.
Thank you, Counselor.
You are.